Thank you. And nice to be here. Welcome to Satsang. Yeah, so as always, I'd like to remind everyone that that Satsang, it's really about you. I know this is called Satsang with Nirmala, but it should really be called Satsang with yourself. That's what we're here to discover, explore, understand more. And so I recently was reminded of years ago that Time magazine, for their person of the year, they had the person of the year was the user of the internet, and they had a computer on the cover, and then literally on the cover of the magazine was a piece of reflective material, so that when you held the magazine up, you were the person of the year. You became the person of the year on Time magazine. And so that's kind of hopefully what this gathering does, is it holds up a mirror, holds up an opportunity for you to really see yourself, and not just the specifics, the individual characteristics of your personality, but your deeper self, your true self. So that's what Satsang is really all about. And in service to that, I always open the discussion up to and invite questions from you, your questions, whatever is important to you, whatever is present for you, whatever is just tickling your curiosity. And that's a wonderful way for you to make Satsang be about you, and also most helpful to you. So you can type the question in on the comment board if you're on the session. You can raise your hand. Actually, I always say that if you really have a burning question, you might want to do both, so that I'm sure to see it. Somebody just raised their hand. So I have some other questions. The last thing I was going to say is that you can also email the questions to me at nirmala@endless-satsang.com. And I got some questions this week via email, and I will try and get to those as the hour unfolds. But let's first see what Joanne would like to speak about today. So I will let go of the mic.
Hi. Yes, I have a general question, really, about spiritual practice. I'll just give you a little background. I've been, basically focusing on the course and, Awakening Together, teachings probably since 2009. So quite a while. And then recently I branched out into some oneness meditation, and I received direct experience from it, and I thought, well, geez, this is pretty interesting. I don't agree with all their teachings. They're talking about manifestation and all this, it almost smells of law of attraction to me. And yet I'm attracted, to the experience of oneness meditation. And then I went and I sat with a guru, one of the disciples of Anandima, I guess they're out of somewhere in San Diego in California, last week. And again, I had direct experience. I felt my kundalini energy like shock right through my body like a bolt of lightning. I burst into tears. And afterwards, I'm like, this is nuts. I'm like, I don't want to, sit around and recite mantras all day, and these teachings just seem so foreign to me. But yeah, I'm receiving direct experience, so I'm kind of confused and I feel a little scattered, and my intuition is telling me that I need to pick what I want to do and focus on it, and just kind of let all the rest settle down or, fall to the wayside. So my question is, am I on the right track of, my intuition telling me, kind of not like pick your poison, but, decide what you're going to do here, and you know, and do it. And it's almost like this is a sleight of hand where I'm scattering my, I could scatter my energies at this point. Okay, I hope my question is clear. Letting go of the mic. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Joanne. That's a really great question. And those who have, you know, listened in the past to some of my talks know that I actually speak very directly about that concern or that question. And I always like to quote my friend Jeffrey Martin, who is a neuroscientist who has studied awakening. And one of the ways he studied it was through interviewing literally over 1,000 people who had a profound awakening. And one of the questions he got very curious about was what particular spiritual practice seemed to be effective for them. And he found it narrowed down somewhat to a group of practices that seemed to come up over and over again. But that what he also kind of uncovered in his research was that there seemed to be a general pattern that any particular spiritual practice that he looked at seemed to work for only about 5 or 6% of the people who encountered it or who pursued it, which seems low. And yet, if it's even remotely accurate, I don't know how exact that figure is, but even if it's somewhere in that ballpark, 1 in 10, 1 in 20 people who, say, take up mantra meditation or encounter a certain kind of self-inquiry or get involved with the Course in Miracles, that for about 1 in 10, 1 in 20 people, it's like a hot knife through butter. It's like it works incredibly well and also surprisingly quickly. When you stumble upon or find your way to a spiritual practice that really works for you, it's very noticeable. It's very, it's undeniable. As you said, your own direct experience of these that you had in these two settings was noticeable. It happened very quickly for you. And that's typical when there's a match, when it's the key that fits the lock. It's obvious fairly quickly when a key is working, and it's obvious fairly quickly when a key isn't working. And so it creates a kind of challenge for anyone on the spiritual path, because no matter what group or practice or teaching that you get drawn to, you may actually be one of the people that it's not a fit for. And yet, there will be people in the room for whom it's working profoundly. And so it's helpful to understand this kind of, I don't know if it's random, but this kind of matching process that can occur as we explore different spiritual practices and teachings. That, even if it seems to be working for your friend and they've been doing it for years and swear by it, that may not mean that it is the practice for you. And so Jeffrey's recommendation, my recommendation, is to really trust your own experience. Cheryl just typed in, discernment is personal. And that's a great way of saying it. It what really matters is your own experience, and to really pay attention to that. Notice what effect the practices have on you. Notice what effect the teachings have on you. And fortunately, it isn't necessary to adopt all of the belief systems that are part of a group in order to take on or explore or try on the practices that they are offering. And so, you said you also had some, that you, Joanne, had some concerns about the kind of the trappings, the stuff that kind of went along with what you were experiencing, which is usually the dogma or the teachings that, they may not be as much of a fit, even if the practice is really having a direct and profound effect on you. So I encourage you to trust your own experience, to when you find something like that, be willing to immerse yourself in it and find out how far you can take it. And one other point about that is that the practice or the process that really fits for you at any particular time can evolve and change. And that even doing a particular practice, like you said, you've been involved with the Course in Miracles now for all these years, that has changed you. That has had an effect on you. And when that happens, that sometimes prepares you or changes you so that a different practice is actually a better fit. This process is so, it has so many levels to it, so many subtleties to it. In one sense, it's a very simple thing to ultimately realize who you really are. But the complexity lies in all of the particular layers of conditioning, particular belief systems, particular energetic imprints, even including your DNA, your past lives, everything that it affects you as an individual, that makes you unique as an individual, that basically needs to be undone, unbelieved, unseen, unraveled, you could say, so that the simple truth becomes more obvious. And in that process, it can be like peeling an onion. There can be layers. And I always wear out metaphors, but you know, the tool that is most useful for removing the skin of the onion may not be the same tool that's most useful for peeling the deeper layers. And that's normal, that's natural, that's, again, you can always just trust your own experience. You should be able to tell very quickly, within a week or two, whether a particular practice or even a particular teaching is a fit for you. And again, it doesn't, you don't have to take the whole, you don't have to buy the whole package in order to like benefit from the practice. You can take what really fits for you and just, you know, just allow them to have their beliefs. You don't have to believe everything they believe, even if the practice is working for you. And I see that you that Joanne raised your hand again, so I hope that means a follow-up question. So I will let go of the mic once more.
Yes, thank you so much. You know, that is along the lines of what I was thinking, basically take what you like and leave the rest like anything else in life. I just didn't want to get led down the garden path, you know, and, you know, lose any ground. I mean, I've been doing a lot of serious spiritual work for many, many years now, and, you know, I don't want to get caught up in any nonsense. I don't want to waste any time if there is such a thing. So thank you for that. My next question is, it's about the physical symptoms that I'm having. It's been going on for about 8 months now. My body moves like whenever it feels. I mean, I almost look like I have MS sometimes. You know, I could just feel the Kundalini energy like really strong going up and down my spine. Sometimes I rock. Sometimes I spin. I try not to do it in front of people. Like if I can feel it, it's coming on. I'm like, oh, you know, like please just stop this. Not now. You know what I mean? They're gonna lock me up and throw away the key. And I'm just wondering about this. You know, obviously it's Kundalini energy. That I understand. And I'm assuming that this is just a phase and that this is going to, it's going to change. You know, I'm wondering, is this physical healing? Is this emotional healing? You know, and or both. Okay, thank you. Letting go of the mic.
Okay, thanks again. That's another great question. You know, first I just reinforce it once again to really trust your own response to things. And so that's how you can separate the wheat from the chaff when you become involved in a spiritual group. And you don't have to, I always say, you know, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but you also don't want to drink the bathwater just because the baby is so cute. So if there is a lot of dogma or belief systems that really don't fit for you, then, you know, just hold them lightly, let them wash over you and focus on what does fit for you. And then as far as the physical symptoms, another thing anyone who's been listening now, you know, to some of these satsangs will recognize is that I like to talk about different levels of truth and how they are all true simultaneously. So anytime someone brings up physical symptoms, just as a basic rule of thumb, it's important to address them on the physical level in case there's something going on. So you know, I don't know if you have or haven't, but you know, it doesn't hurt to actually check in with someone who you trust as some kind of medical practitioner, either you know, conventional medicine or alternative medicine, but someone that can just talk to you about it on that level, and maybe just, you know, who knows, maybe run a few tests, and just make sure there's nothing specific happening on that level, because even if it is a spiritual, you know, completely spiritual cause or completely spiritual process that is unfolding through physical symptoms, then there still may be a lot that someone, a skillful practitioner, can do to either address the symptoms or, oh, it's triggered by prayer. Joanne just typed in, it's triggered by prayer. Yeah, so that, you know, again, that's very suggestive that it's both a spiritual cause and a spiritual phenomenon. It's still, like I said, it's sort of like a warning on the package of my teachings, where I always would want to also stress that it doesn't hurt to find out if there's something physical that can be addressed on that level. So that being said, these energy experiences are very common, very normal. It's just part of the process. You know, you can think of it like, you know, the transformation process that would happen if you started running higher voltage current through your house wires. You know, it would change a lot of things. And so it's not unusual. It happens. It's, you know, I don't know whether it's a good sign or a bad sign, and it often is, you know, correct that it's best defined or labeled as kundalini, because that's a kind of catch-all phrase for these kind of energetic effects. And there is, you know, a whole science of study of that unfolding. I'm not by any means an expert in kundalini, and I wouldn't want to try and diagnose someone's kundalini process over the internet like this. But there's one perspective I can share about the unfolding of kundalini, and that is that when it is disruptive. Oh, someone interjected here a question, what is kundalini is, which might be actually important for anyone, in this discussion, just because if, you know, that's what we're talking about, might as well try and define it a little bit. Kundalini is often thought of as an energy in the body, a kind of spiritual force that runs through various channels in the body. Ultimately, Kundalini is really the divine feminine. It's ultimately the goddess Shakti. That is really what is causing the symptoms, causing the experiences of energy. And the energy itself is better actually labeled as prana. It is energy. It is a subtle kind of energy. And yet the important part of the movement of energy, this energy through the various nadis and channels in the body, and through the chakras, most people are familiar with chakras, which are associated with these channels. The actual controlling force is this dimension of reality, which is beyond really our concept of a goddess. It's really the divine feminine. It's the manifest aspect of the ultimate reality. And when, you know, the goddess of the entire universe, when the queen of the universe wants to change your subtle body system, it's going to change. You're going to have potentially these symptoms, a lot of symptoms, shaking, aches and pains, fatigue, sudden spontaneous movements, even very specific movements, like often people will unconsciously start forming mudras with their hands, which are very specific traditional positions that people put their hands in during meditation and so forth to affect the subtle body, and that can just spontaneously start to happen. The person who asked about Kundalini says, Cheryl says that her heart opens wide and feel a spontaneous feeling of love and tears appear. That could be Kundalini. That could just be a heart opening experience. The Kundalini is, there's a whole, like I said, there's a whole science of Kundalini. And it seems to be related to and affected by everything else that's happening to us spiritually. But it isn't always the same thing. There can be spiritual openings that involve Kundalini, involve these energetic experiences more or less, where this shifting of the subtle body system is more or less a factor. So not everything, you know, that gets labeled Kundalini is Kundalini, and not everything that people experience where they have no idea about Kundalini is not Kundalini. It still could be the Kundalini could be a factor. So what to do when there's a lot of symptoms of Kundalini? The simplest and most helpful advice is to just allow it, accept it, let, you know, the divine intelligence that is unfolding that experience knows what it's doing. And so to some extent, the more you can, just allow it and not either try to make it happen or try to make it stop happening, then that's ideal. Sometimes in the practical unfolding of daily life, as Joanne herself mentioned, it's helpful to have a way to kind of stifle it, you know, to kind of calm it down. In fact, more medical or Western-oriented traditions, they actually encourage people to eat a lot of meat and watch a lot of television, and those things seem to calm down the spiritual forces and give people relief from their symptoms. And maybe, you know, short of anything else, that might be a useful, you know, at least a useful option. I would only use it very temporarily, you know, anything you... just like a lot of Western medicine, if you stifle the symptoms, that doesn't necessarily actually resolve the underlying condition. So the problems reappear. Again, the simplest thing you can do is allow it, accept it, let it have its way with you. One thing that is very profoundly helpful is any form of meditation. When you put yourself, actually any form of spiritual practice, but meditation is a wonderfully kind of neutral practice where you just make yourself available to what is naturally happening anyways. And so any form of meditation, any form of anything that helps you have in Vedic terms what they call a more sattvic life. And sattvic things are things that could bring you more peace, more spaciousness, allow a calmness, calming of your body's energy. And so Cheryl typed in going outside grounds her as well. And so yeah, that, I mean, spending more time outdoors. So rather than trying to stifle the symptoms, you make space for them. You try and make your life more calming and spacious and easeful, less stressful in the body. And then that allows this process to unfold more. It's more like the alternative approach to healing and medicine, is to allow the body's natural processes to do what they need to do. You allow the Kundalini to do what it needs to do. So again, meditation is a very profound way to make space for these kind of energetic effects. And it's okay if you sit down to meditate and you get swept up in a powerful flow of these prana energies, and you spend your whole meditation shaking or twitching or and feeling strong energy symptoms. And then also, like I said, part of this allowing them is to also just allow it when they stop happening. Because, sometimes subtly or not so subtly, we can also get attached to the experiences of Kundalini. And so then we might suffer or struggle a little bit if they don't happen. it's a funny kind of duality there, that sometimes people get a little attached to the sensations, especially if they're pleasurable, because sometimes it's a somewhat blissful or pleasurable sensation of the energy moving. Now, the last thing I'll mention, because that works, to a degree. And by the way, another nice universal prescription for Kundalini is alternate nostril breathing. If you're not familiar with it, you can do a Google search. And it's just a kind of one size fits all breathing practice that is very balancing for the subtle energy body. So that's a great one for anyone to try. And Joanne says, great, okay, so I think she maybe got what she needed here, but I'll just mention, because you brought up the topic, that when one perspective on Kundalini is that when the goddess, when the Shakti goddess is working and doing what she needs to do, and there's very little resistance or interference, it's often a very smooth, kind of unremarkable experience, actually. And that when the symptoms are very strong, when they're very intense, that's usually actually a sign that there's some, I don't know what the right word is, some kind of imbalance or block or something, some potential for a gentle and hopefully skillful kind of corrective process to be introduced into the system. And the challenge there is to find someone who knows what they're doing, because as you get more subtle in the spiritual journey, as you get more subtle in your spiritual experience, as you start to experience these Kundalini effects, you become like a super high-end violin or race car or something, where everything, every slightest little thing that's out of tune could have more dramatic effects. And so having, you don't necessarily want the kid at your local garage that just, has just learned how to change tires and maybe fix brakes to go to work on your $300,000 Ferrari. Instead you want to take it to someone who's a real expert at that kind of fine-tuned machine. And so the trick is to find someone who actually knows how to individually address what's happening in your subtle body. Again, I'm not an expert in that regard. I do have a place that I can refer to or recommend It's in Tennessee, of all places, and it's called Patanjali Kundalini Yoga Center or Yoga Care. I can't remember. Their web address, I believe, is kundaliniyogacare.com. Maybe someone could type that in real quick and see if that's it. So it's PKYC is the name of the place. It's in Tennessee. There's this wonderful woman there, Joan or Shiva Party, who is the lineage holder. Yeah, it's PKYC. If you do a Google search for PKYC, it should come up. And the web address, I believe, is kundaliniyogacare, all one word, .com. It's a fairly demanding thing to work with them. They do an initial consultation or evaluation of your kundalini process, and that's not as involved and gives you a chance to kind of kundaliniyogacare.com, where yoga is in there. And so I can't recommend them highly enough. They there you go, you got it. So they what's unique about them, and what's I think makes them so profoundly effective in what they do, is that they vary to a very extreme extent. They work with each person individually. They design a set of practices and processes that are unique to you. So even if you have if you go there on a retreat and there's a half dozen other people in the room who are on a retreat with you, when it comes time to do your practices, everybody in the room will be doing something completely different. And that's what's so special about what they're able to do, is they can tune into and then address your subtle body right where it is. So that, you know, that it's that they're mostly interested in working with very serious and committed spiritual seekers, and their skill level is a match to that kind of person when, especially like I said, when there's a very disruptive kundalini process. That's when they can really, they're like the master mechanics of the subtle body that I'm aware of, the best for that kind of thing. All right, so enough about kundalini. Okay, let me see. Yeah, that kundaliniyoga.org. Oh, let me just click on the link to see. If that, I just want to make sure that the link that Cheryl posted is the right one. It's not, the link is working. I don't know why my website might. Nope, that's not working either. Let me try one more thing. Oh, it is just kundalinicare.com. I don't know why I thought there was a yoga in the word. But yeah, it is just kundalinicare.com. That is the specific website. Again, and the PKYC stands for Patanjali Kundalini Yoga Care. And there's a beautiful picture of the Swamiji who recently passed away. And then below that is a picture of Joan, who is the current person leading it. Yeah, kundalinicare.com. You had it right in the first place. All right. So, again, I'll open it up to any other questions. You can type them or raise your hand. And maybe I'll also jump into one of the questions I've got as a question through email. And someone wrote and said, this is their question. I experience different energies in different cities. Some places have energies that seem to be more compatible to my energy being than others. It seems living in a town that feels more compatible would be beneficial to one's spiritual growth and deepening. And yet she also says some Advaita teachers kind of dismiss this. And that's true. I would say of a lot of invited teachers, it's that they tend to dismiss a lot. it's part of the, I think, both the strength and weakness of Advaita, that it views everything from a very absolute kind of perspective. Yeah, that's it. That's the link, kundalinicare.com. So actually, I'll address this first by using a metaphor. I live in Sedona, and there are all these amazing, beautiful rock formations around here. It's kind of like the top third of the Grand Canyon. It's like living in a beautiful place, spot like the Grand Canyon. And one of the things that's really wonderful about it is when you go hiking, as you work your way down a trail, as you move closer to and move past the various rocks, the view is always changing. The way the rocks appear is always changing. And as you get closer to the rocks, they look totally different than they do from a distance. You start seeing details of the cliff face that you couldn't see from further away, the rock formations. And then if it's an in and out hike, it's great because when you turn around, it's like a whole different hike. You're hiking back, and the rocks all look different from the other direction. And so these questions, these kind of practical questions about, what is or isn't supportive of your spiritual journey, it kind of comes back to what we were first talking about, is this learning to trust what is true for you. And what's important for you, what matters. And you can start to get a sense of this if you just reflect back on your life and what mattered to you at certain points in your life that doesn't matter anymore, and what has taken its place and matters now. I was reflecting when I first read the question. I was reflecting about how when I was like in third or fourth grade, how incredibly important it was to me when the ice cream truck came down the street and rang its bell. I mean, it just seemed like so important to me to have some ice cream at that moment. And it was really a big deal. When I was like 8 or 9 years old, there was nothing that mattered more. And, if I could convince my mom and she'd give me enough money and I'd go out. I remember a couple times she gave me enough money to buy a banana split from the ice cream truck. And it just, I still remember it. It was just such a profound experience. But of course, further down the trail, ice cream and, especially the kind of ice cream they sell on the street from ice cream trucks is it's still part of my life, but it's just not that important. My perspective on it has changed. The importance of it has changed. And so, that's a really simplistic metaphor. But this question of finding, energies, places to live, things that are more compatible with your system, at certain points that will be really important. And all you can do is trust your own experience. Notice what happens for you if you ignore those intuitions about what would be an ideal place for you to live, and notice what happens when you follow them. And as you become more trusting of that response, it will again naturally change you. The practice of following your intuition will over time change you and possibly make the things that were important less important. And so at some point you may actually have a similar perspective to the Advaita teachers who say, they tend to suggest that it's all just phenomenon, it's all just a part of the illusion that these energetic effects matter. And that might, at some point that might be true for you. But if it's not true for you, if you're still approaching the rocks, not coming back from the other direction, if you're still, your view and your direct experience, it does have a profound effect, then it's probably worth taking it into account. And again, at the very least, being curious about it, exploring it, And of course, life itself will always give you lots of opportunities to be in places that feel more energetically appropriate and places or around people that feel less energetically appropriate. So there's always a chance to kind of test the waters and find out how important is it still. You know, like I said, ice cream isn't that important to me. Other things that were extremely important in my life, when I'm thinking of sexuality. When I first discovered and started exploring my sexuality, it seemed like a really, really big deal. And just like I still eat ice cream, I still experience my sexuality. I'm still curious about it. It's still, you know, at times a worthwhile experience, but it's not as important. It's not the primary focus. And so the same thing with, as you get to these more subtle experiences, it's just useful to really trust your own direct response. What is it that is actually softening, opening, expanding, freeing your awareness? And if, you know, if a particular teacher validates that, great. And if a particular teacher invalidates that, but it's still true for you, then that's their problem, not yours. So I hope that's a little helpful in terms of making those kinds of more subtle discriminations, more subtle choices in life as you become more sensitive, as you become more, it's like as your system becomes more purified. Again, you're more like the expensive sports car or the super expensive violin that needs to be, you know, you would only let someone who really knows what they're doing work on a Stradivarius, because after, you know, 200 or 300 years, it's going to be a delicate process to repair or tune a Stradivarius. And that's what we become. We become more and more finely tuned to, up to, and including the point where these things matter less again. At a certain point, as you transcend even that kind, those kind of subtle aspects of experience, then they suddenly stop mattering as much again. And if that's your experience, then you can trust that. You can kind of just go, you know, it's sort of like the Zen saying about, you know, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, and then there is. And, you know, you can't always just jump ahead to the, you know, to the wisdom of the final perspective. You sometimes need to go through the process and go through, you know, when you're first, often when you're young and first starting out in life, these things don't matter really. You just kind of bowl your way through whatever shows up, wherever you're drawn to. And then, as you become more and more finely tuned, it's like there's a whole, you know, the whole spiritual process and journey and subtleties of that all start to matter more. And you can listen to that. You can follow that until they suddenly don't matter anymore. And you can become remarkably normal and natural. I love how one of my teachers, Adyashanti, often says how he's like one of the least spiritual people he knows. and it's true. He likes watching monster trucks on TV. He is an avid poker player. He even likes to go to casinos and play poker in the casinos. He's just at a place where he's not affected anymore by particular energetic concerns or questions. He was a vegetarian for years, and then one day he woke up and he realized he didn't need to do that anymore, and he literally went out and bought a great big bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken and ate the whole damn thing in one sitting. He said he felt great. So, and by the way, this whole process can unfold in layers. Like I used the metaphor before of the peeling of the onion. And so you may go through periods where you're in this. In fact, I think it often happens with each new kind of breakthrough, is that you come to a place where you're not, you just seem kind of, you've kind of transcended, you're not affected by things. And then So you can come to a place where you can hang out in the casino all day and eat Kentucky Fried Chicken, and it doesn't matter. However, even that may just be part of of the next unfolding, and you may once again find that you hit the next layer, and that suddenly you need to be very focused on kind of caring for and adapting to the subtle energy impulses, the subtle effects that things are having on your energy system. The person who wrote that question also had a second question. She said, since her direct experience of all beings being danced by the divine, so she had a kind of awakening to that it's all one being danced by the divine. She says that after that she has no motivation, no desire, and it seems the whole movement of being on the spiritual path has dissolved. And so this is sort of like another aspect of what we've actually been talking about this whole satsang. That there's different degrees to which you're affected by subtle energies. There's different degrees to which different spiritual practices or processes fit or are needed at all, depending on all these, as you move through the different layers of your being, the different levels of truth. And one of those factors that changes, and sometimes quite dramatically, like it sounds like it is for her, is this question of motivation. I think I know this woman, and I think it goes a little bit beyond just not having motivation to do spiritual practices. It's also just not having motivation, period. And last week I spoke about this some last time, where I spoke about that a very normal and natural and actually it's actually a positive sign that a normal part of this process is that we can hit these pockets of emptiness. That among the layers of the onion, as you're peeling it back, will be these layers that seem, at least relatively, and sometimes radically so, that seem empty, dry. Any sense of something missing or lacking, it can be a very strong experience of that. There can be a lack of clarity, a lack of sweetness, joy, pleasure. And one expression of that is this lack of motivation. And very often when you're a serious, curious, inspired, spiritual explorer, and you want to get to as much of the truth as you can in this lifetime, you want the juicy stuff. You want the stuff that you bite into, and it's like really intense and really profound. And then you bite into something or just arises in you, and it's empty and it's dry and it feels sort of lacking and like there's nothing there, or you can't find any sense of motivation or desire or any impulse. The usual way that you would kind of guide your actions was to, what do I feel like doing? What do I want to do? What am I motivated by? And yet, when you go there, it's missing, it's lacking, it's an empty space. And very often, the tendency then is to pull back, to turn away, to go look somewhere else, to try to, fill up that emptiness. I mean, we do this at all levels of our spiritual journey. A lot of people in the world are trying to fill up their emptiness with, food, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And it's never enough. You can't fill up the emptiness in that way. And as you get more subtle, the experiences of this emptiness or lack or something missing they also get very, very subtle. And yet, this more subtle experiences can often be actually more impactful, more profound, more difficult in a sense. If you think that there's something wrong when you feel a total lack of motivation. And the antidote, it's a strange, strange antidote. The suggestion, the invitation that I would invite you to, the possibility that I would invite you to explore, is to actually move into the emptiness, to embrace it, to really take it on as a great opportunity to really feel, sense, experience, be curious about the space itself, the whole, H-O-L-E, where motivation used to be, where joy used to be, where some kind of juiciness used to be. And when you go in wholeheartedly, completely, with as much a curiosity and attention and subtlety of discrimination as you can into that emptiness, then you can be profoundly surprised by what you discover that is present in what seemed to be emptiness. It's one of the common descriptions of a spiritual breakthrough is people are amazed at how full something that felt empty turns out to be. And so that's one expression of this invitation, this possibility of going deeper into emptiness. And very surprisingly, sometimes the thing that feels like it's missing is present in the space where it seems like it's missing. Only it's a more subtle, more profound, more essential version of it. So you may find motivation, but it's a totally different kind of motivation. It's more like you are, you know, she said she had a realization of being danced by the divine, and you may find that, you know, true motivation doesn't feel anything like the motivation that used to get you to go out on Friday night and party, or go out, you know, or even go to all kinds of spiritual groups and meditate your ass off and try and be as, you know, spiritual as you possibly could. There may be this totally unexpected kind of motivation that just moves you without any rhyme or reason as far as your mind can tell. And so, you know, be curious and open to it appearing, what appears in that emptiness being totally unexpected, unrecognizable really, from what you were maybe even looking for when you went seeking within for that experience. And I'm going to say one more thing about this question about motivation, which may seem contradictory, and it probably applies to all of these questions, is that there's a balance. You know, even as you're diving deeply into the space of emptiness that arises within yourself, even as you're opening yourself up to more and more to the will of the divine, it also never hurts. It's kind of like what I said earlier to Joanne about, you know, it never hurts to go see a doctor and just check and see if there's something physical going on. Specifically when it comes to motivation, it never hurts to also sometimes just get up and start doing something. On a very practical human level, motivation often appears after we start doing, the sense of, you know, energy and motivation to do something often shows up when we're doing it, not beforehand. And especially when you're just kind of moving more spontaneously, more freely, you know, there may not be a lot of a buildup of charge, a buildup of motivation before you get busy. And so to allow yourself to get up and do something at the slightest whim, to just, in the case of motivation, to just respond to whatever kind of presents itself. You know, the doorbell rings, the phone rings, you get an email, there's a, you know, your eye is caught by a poster at the health food store, and you just say, huh, and you know, you just say yes to it, and you just say, you know, you just go to the meeting, go to the experience, or you know, say yes when your friend asks you if you'll help them move, or say yes when someone you don't know emails you and wants to start a dialogue, or whatever it is. Sometimes it helps to just start doing. A great example of this, which probably everyone has experienced, is the way your motivation often kicks in after you start exercising, not before. Anyone who has, you know, been involved with any form of exercise, yoga, swimming, hiking, biking, the whole gamut, you may know that experience that, you know, when you're, especially here, it gets hot in the summer, so my wife and I like to take our dog for a walk real early in the morning. And a lot of times, you know, at 6 a.m., there isn't actually a lot of motivation to go for a walk. And, you know, thank God we have a dog, because we know that he kind of really needs it. So we just put on our shoes and we go out the door. And boy, you know, you get out there, it's still kind of cool, and the birds are singing. And before you know it, you know, it's just like the best thing to be out on a walk, even though there wasn't. And so the motivation is there. It just came after we started walking, not before. So these can seem like contradictory pointings, where I say, you know, just go into the emptiness, allow yourself to really experience the absence of motivation, to really just sit in that space, in that place of lack. And then, you know, it's, again, it can seem contradictory to say, just get up and start doing something, even if there is no motivation. I think that if you apply both, if you're willing sometimes to just sit with the absence of motivation, other times to get up and just start doing something, whatever kind of presents itself. And as you dance, as you allow yourself the kind of flexibility to move in both directions, then there will be a natural intelligence that knows when one or the other is really more appropriate. And you'll discover that these kind of suggestions or invitations or possible approaches, either just allowing yourself to not feel motivation or to get up and do something, that they're actually complementary. That my sense is that what happens as we become more subtle is really that we just become more flexible. We're able to move more freely in and out of all the different levels of our being, including the very human ones, where a certain amount of motivation, or you could even trim it down to a certain amount of actual physical activity, is just part of life. And when there's no resistance, you know, when it's time to get up and walk the dog, you get up and walk the dog. And when there isn't anything else pressing, when there isn't anything else that's naturally arising to do, you're utterly content to sit in stillness, to sit in a relative experience of emptiness, or, you know, what the mind could label lack. But at that point, you may not really label it lack anymore if you've developed this a kind of taste for it, a connoisseur's appreciation of emptiness and silence and stillness. But there's no contradiction to having that same richness of appreciation for and willingness to experience activity and movement and doing it when the spirit moves you, when the divine does something through you. You just get up and dig the ditch, even though there was no motivation and you had no idea that's what you would be doing in that time. All right, so try it both ways. See what happens if you go back and forth and every other which way. All right, so that's the end of my hour. You're very welcome, Joanne. I'm glad that it was helpful, if it was. And I see your question about the name of the satsang. I'll give it a little reflection, then I'll type it in here. And because I just haven't been focusing on that. But in the meantime, I'll let go of the mic so that I believe it's Regina that's on next, so she can get going. All right, thanks a lot. See you all next week if you can make it. Bye for now.